If I were a gospel writer back in the day, I think that I probably would have written a gospel slightly different than what's been written now. As we go through this, one of the things that makes the gospels so realistic to read is not its content. The content is often rather fantastic, someone dying and someone coming back to life. Again, sometimes even hard for us to accept as a truth. But what we're going to be seeing today is people's reactions to the death of Christ. What should have happened with gospel writers is they should have painted the followers of Jesus in the best light possible. I mean, wouldn't that make sense? If I were going to write a history about my life, the people closest to me would receive the greatest amount of attention and also the greatest words being spoken. In the Gospels, though, the people who are often most honored and revered are all the people you would not expect it to be. As we read through this, I'm going to point out the fringe people. The people that shouldn't be playing a role in this, but somehow have made it into Scripture and share proof that this stuff actually happened. This wasn't just some sort of fairy tale that showed everyone in a good light. It actually shows the followers of Jesus in a somewhat negative light, as most of them are gone, as Peter has denied Jesus, as Judas has betrayed Jesus, and as best as we can tell, only John is present when the crucifixion takes place. So all the close people, the close men of Jesus, are painted in a somewhat unflattering light. But then there's others. The women, who back in the day would have no real standing, no real status, they're lifted up. Pilate, the infamous hand washer, the crazy germaphobe who says, I don't want to have anything to do with this. He does something very strange. The guards who are there to make sure that Jesus dies, their reaction to this is strange. The priests, remember the evil chief priests we've been talking about? Something strange happens. All of these outsiders, these non-believers, end up experiencing and seeing the death of Christ in a way that moves them to faith. I'm always thankful for my Christian upbringing, but I'm also keenly aware that not everyone has that same experience. And that if you are one who comes from something other than a Christian background, it's okay, because the offer still stands. You're invited to come and look, see what happens, gaze upon it and meditate on it and think about it, but most importantly, respond to it. You can't just hear this material and walk away and go, oh, that was an interesting story. Eventually, you've got to say, what's my reaction to this? Much like the passage when Peter talks about who Jesus is, Jesus asked them, who do you say I am? That's an important thing. Who do you say? As we see this, the disciples are gone, but everyone else is responding to the death of Jesus. Now, the death of Jesus and his subsequent resurrection obviously impact the disciples in such a profound way that it ultimately changes the course of history. They take a 2,000-year-old, 3,000-year-old tradition of having church on Saturday to all of a sudden it's changed to Sunday. Something big must have happened. You go from these disciples who are scared and running and not being a part of anything to those who are now championing Jesus' message and willing to actually die in order to support it. The explosion of the early church all gives witness to the power of Christ's death and resurrection. It's not just for the church, it's for everyone. So let's take a look at this story again from Matthew's vantage point. Jesus has been mocked, he's been flogged, he has been stripped down twice. He is probably now going through hypovolemic shock. He's now probably very cold. He is hurting. He is tired. He's been up all night. We are seeing Jesus at these low points. And now he is sent out to go be crucified. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. Who is this Simon? What do we know about him? We know nothing. But the one thing we do know is that when the gospel writers write about Simon, that's all they say. Oh yeah, Simon from Cyrene is forced to carry the cross. And the inference behind that is everyone should know who Simon is. At the time of this writing, Simon must have been a part of the church because that's all they reference. Here is this outsider who's come into Passover, come into Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, and now he is somehow caught up in this gigantic mess. Jesus is stumbling. He's tired. He can no longer carry either the full cross or the cross beam. And as that wood, as those splinters gouge into his already wounded back, causing extreme pain, as his body starts giving way because of his pain, he can no longer carry the cross. Last week I told you about my hamstring issue. Remember that? Yeah. Well, did the splits. My hamstring hurts. So I'm on the mend. I'm thinking everything's fine. And then Monday happened. So Monday I'm sitting trying to just let my leg rest, and the dogs were scratching at the back door, and so I went to open it, and I had not realized that the back gate had been left open. So as I open the door, the dogs start running. And I'm like, I've got to stop the dogs. So in my 46-year-old state with my wounded hamstring, I start to run thinking everything is fine. As I get to my flagstone pathway in the back, I am stretching out with my foot and my hamstring gives way. And my left heel digs right into the flagstone, one of the flagstones, a point, and it shreds off a big hunk of flesh. I collapse onto my right knee, which bruises it. It scrapes up the top of my foot. I bruise my left palm. But it was my ego that was damaged the most. The dogs kept running. That was the hard part. And so I get up and I am struggling back into the house. I don't even know if you're not even aware of this yet, Joshua. I get back into the house because Joshua's on spring break, and I start screaming for my youngest, Joshua! But he's in his bedroom watching something, and I can't, and I'm like, I am in so much pain. And thankfully then, there's a knock at the door. And my across-the-street neighbor, Ellie, for some reason, the dogs love her because they ran straight across the street. I said, what happened? She said, they just both came to my door, and so they shouldn't be out. And she's like, are you okay? And of course, I'm good. I'm just kind of standing there like, yeah, I'm good. Yeah, ring dogs, I'm good. Yeah, hey, thanks, Ellie. Thanks, Ellie. Shut the door, collapse. I am in pain. It's one thing to be injured. It's then another thing to have another injury on top of another injury. And this is, again, something that it's hard for us to understand when we see Christ's pain. He can't carry the weight of the cross anymore. He has no energy left. He really hasn't had anything to eat or drink for about 12 hours. He's lost a lot of blood. He has been beaten beyond recognition. And now he's required to carry this crossbeam, and he just can't do it anymore. His legs give out. He falls to the ground. They look over. They find some guy, some random guy, who had really nothing to do with anything, and they force him, "You carry this man's cross." They come to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Skull in Latin is Calvaria, which is why we talk about the cross of Calvary. And there they offer Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall. Because let me tell you, if you are in pain and if you are hurting, one thing that can help dull the pain is just a little bit of alcohol. No, I did not have any. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when I had pulled my hamstring and ripped my heel and blah, 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 blah. Though I really was tempted because I was in a lot of pain. Jesus is now dying of thirst. He is in horrendous pain and he's offered a little bit of relief. Isn't it interesting? They're offering Jesus some relief. As the liquid is put to his lips, he realizes that it's alcoholic, and he refuses to drink it, not because there's anything wrong with drinking alcohol, but Jesus, through this whole thing, has one focus in mind, and that is, I'm going to pay the price for the sins of the world, and I will feel it all. I will feel every ounce of pain. I will not be deadened in my senses. I will do it because that's the depth of love. And that also tells us that when we go through things that are physically overwhelming, when the pain gets too great in our lives, Jesus says, I know how you feel. And though we find things to deaden our senses, and I think rightfully so, any way that we can cope, Jesus did not. He felt it all. So when they offered him the wine, he refused to drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. 36, and sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Bonus points if you can tell me who wrote that. Pilate. Even more bonus points if you can tell me how many languages he wrote in. Three. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Matthew doesn't spell it out, but another gospel writer says that the chief priests, the teachers of the law, they came and they're like, no, don't you dare write Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. What you need to write is he claimed to be King of the Jews. And what does Pilate say? He says, what I have written, I have written. Does it make you wonder about Pilate? Why would he write Jesus Nazareth, King of the Jews? Is there a possibility that this man, after seeing all that he had done to him, realized his guilt and his blame and comes to faith? Writing it in three languages is almost this emphatic statement of how deep Pilate believes it. And then also beyond that, it's a testimony to as many people as possible walking by that someone would be able to read at least one of those languages. And in Latin, I'm going to butcher it because I don't speak Latin very well. But Jesu Nazareth Rex Yehuda, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. You take the first letters of all those, it spells I-N-R-I. So if you've ever seen pictures and images of Jesus and right above his head is the four letters I-N-R-I, that's what that stands for. Pilate, possibly being saved. You've got two robbers crucified with him, verse 38, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." Others join in the same way. The chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. Interesting phrase that they say here. He saved others. Isn't that an interesting statement? He saved others. It's almost as if they know he is somehow special, but that specialness of him and his love and his care for other people was not enough to affect themselves. They were ones who continued to watch and said, "I don't believe this." And they said, "But we would believe under one condition." And look what they say. They said, "But he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And here they put out this false choice. If Jesus would have come down from the cross, a couple of chief priests and teachers of the law might have believed that he was the Son of God, but it would have damned you and I to hell. And Jesus is not one who fights against something just on principle. He sees how important our lives are, and his incredible love for us keeps him on the cross. And in the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults in him, and were thankful again for other gospel writers who note that one of those robbers came to faith. Another outsider, someone who shouldn't be saved. This doesn't make sense. Why are all of these people on the fringe showing faith? It's because they see what is happening with Jesus, and it is enough to move them. It is enough to change their hearts, because they came and they saw and they responded to what was happening. Verse 45. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. What is the sixth hour and what is the ninth hour? 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Did anyone do the eclipse thingy? Did anyone go to a total blackout zone? Remember, you guys are looking at me like I'm crazy. The eclipse. Okay, did anyone go and you went? You went. Did you? You were in a zone that it was total darkness. Okay, it was freaky. So tell me, because it was funny. I was watching it on the news, and it was very bizarre seeing the sun completely wiped out. What was it like? Yeah, yeah, and I remember. As I was in my backyard, because I didn't go anywhere, did you all just feel this kind of weird sense of, it's getting a little darker and it feels like my eyes are not working quite right? It was strange, huh? Yeah. How long did it last? 2 minutes. What would happen if it lasted for 3 hours? Would that terrify you? 3 hours. So, question, was this some sort of solar eclipse? If it was a solar eclipse, then also time stood still. 3 hours of darkness. Why? Because in the Old Testament, darkness was a picture and a symbol of God's judgment and wrath. And during this time, it is as if God is withdrawing his presence from this situation. And I think we've all felt that. Have you ever felt the time in your life when it felt like God just was gone? And how terrifying was that? More terrifying than 3 hours of darkness, I'll tell you this. Because normally it doesn't last for 3 hours. Normally it lasts for days, weeks, months. hear God's displeasure, his wrath upon not only mankind, but now transferred completely and utterly onto one person who became the embodiment and picture of sin. Every sin you and I have ever committed, every careless word we've spoken, every heinous act we've committed, every dirty thought we've thought is now laid upon Jesus. And the sight of this disgusting human being from God's vantage point was so wrong and so heinous, God couldn't even look at him. And darkness now covers the land. And during that time of darkness, as it's getting near the end, Jesus cries out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" which is the first line of Psalm 22. Some people think that maybe Jesus was going to quote the rest of the psalm. If you ever want to read a really eerie, creepy psalm, Psalm 22 is it. It's pretty disturbing. But what's also interesting is what psalm comes after Psalm 22? It's interesting. I think as the psalms were compiled, this idea of the pain we sometimes experience with God leaving us or forsaking us or abandoning us, this feeling we get of utter darkness in our life, is quickly followed up with, but God is with me, and his rod and his staff, they comfort me. And even if I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. There's an interesting little tradition that the Jewish people had, and that was if someone who was a righteous person was dying an innocent death, Elijah would show up and rescue that person. So this becomes another one of those great little litmus tests. He says, "Eloi, Eloi," it sounds like Eli, Eli, and I don't know how some got from Eli to Elijah, and I don't know how Psalm 22 figures into this whole theory of Elijah showing up, but they're looking for something. They're waiting for something. The problem is they've only put one test on it. They've only said, this is the only way we will believe is if you do this. If Elijah comes, we know you're righteous. If you come down from the cross right here, right now, we know you're righteous. And we've got to be very careful anytime we put these kind of tests on God. God, I'll believe you if you allow me to pass this class. God, if only I could get that job, I will believe in you. Lutherans themselves are not immune to this because of our own namesake, Martin Luther, in the middle of a storm, doesn't even have the guts to cry out to God himself, but cries out to the saint, "If you get me out of this, I will become a monk and follow you." It's interesting how we often put these tests on God, but does God need any testing? Does God need to prove anything to us? That's the reason why all of these insiders seem to be missing this boat. The outsiders are watching this man die. They're watching how he handles himself. They're seeing his whole life in totality. They see all the things he had done up until then. He sees how he's not fighting back. They're probably wondering, is it going to be true that he's going to come back in 3 days? But at that point, it didn't matter. The totality of the evidence was overwhelming, and they're starting to come to faith. Well, the insiders are saying, nope, I'll only do it if you do this one thing for me. But I have a feeling that even if Jesus had done that one thing, they still wouldn't believe. After he's performed miracles, after he's fed 5,000 people, the Pharisees and teachers of the law approach him and say, "Hey, can you do a miracle for us?" He's like, "Are you kidding me? I just fed 5,000 people. Do you know how hard that is?" No, he didn't actually say that, but this is the weird thing. "Oh, just do one more miracle for us. Just do one more thing, and then I'll believe you. Knock it off. There is no need for it. The evidence is already there. You already know that it's true. Stop with the disbelief. Put your trust in God, and you'll see some amazing things happen." Jesus even tells a parable about this. When someone dies and ends up going to hell, and he tells the story about how it was terrible, and this guy, somehow filled with compassion for his brother, say, "Hey, can I go back and just warn my brothers that hell is real and that they should follow after God?" And it was very interesting because Jesus says this really funky thing. It's a parable. It's not a real story. It's a parable, and he says, even if someone came back from the dead, they still wouldn't believe it. Interesting. Even if they had... I have a feeling that if Jesus would have levitated down off the cross, a great story would have been invented. I bet if Elijah had appeared and yanked out the nails, if angels had come down with flaming swords, they would all stand there and go, "Wow, we had something really bad to eat last night because we are all having this crazy hallucination." It didn't matter what happened. They were already seared in their unbelief. But for those who just simply saw what was happening, they responded in faith. Verse 47, when some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. And the rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. And now the pain and the misery that he had been feeling up until then, the weight of the sin on his shoulders, the separation he had from God the Father, everything that happened up until now is finally complete. And he dies. What's very interesting about this is when Jesus dies, people live. People seeing all of this stuff happening are responding. But you know the weirdest thing that happens is that it comes true literally. We're going to see now some people, an event take place that is so impacting that later on it talks about how some of the chief priests, some of the religious leaders actually started believing in Jesus. I have a feeling, I can't prove it, but I have a feeling it's because of this next instance. Because at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, how thick is this curtain? About 4 inches thick. I want you to... Have you ever tried to rip a phone book? Some of you are like, "What's a phone book?" It's this thing us old people used to use where we just looked up someone's number in the phone directory. We also did it a while ago in youth group. They can verify this. Do you know that it is impossible to put an egg in your hand and squeeze it until it breaks? You don't believe me. And you're going to go home and you're going to try it. Now let me tell you, a youth told us this and we didn't believe it. Is that, remember this, Maddie? It's frustrating. It's an egg. They break easily. Oh yeah, and faith. Yeah, and it was really funny. It didn't break. How can we not break an egg? I don't know either. I'm sure there's scientific proof and stuff like this. Now imagine yes, I'm sure. Thank you, John. I'm sure you could explain it. I think it's something about tensile strength, and it's spread out over the egg of the shell because you can't dig your fingers in. If you dig your fingers in, you can actually break it. But let the record reflect, by the way. Maddie, there was one person that night that did break the egg. Who was that? Jesus? No. If you don't know the answer, just say Jesus. Daisy, were you there? Who broke the egg? I did. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you. Rachel was there. I broke the egg. So I could have probably torn a phone book too. No, I can't. I can't tear a phone book. Yeah, try. Yeah, could you imagine? 4 inches thick of a curtain going to the top. Why top to bottom? Well, because we could probably come up with some sort of reason why bottom to top. Yeah. How does someone levitate up to the top to rip it? They can't. Why top to bottom? Now, could you imagine, you're sitting there, and you're watching over the sacrifices, you've got priest duty, and there's one thing, remember, that you just dare not do. You do not go into the Holy of Holies. That's why there's a 4-foot thick curtain that separates the two, because if you go into that Holy of Holies on a day other than Yom Kippur, and on a day on, and you are someone other than the head priest, what happens to you? Death. There's the right answer. It's always death or Jesus. And so here, could you imagine, you're sitting there just, I don't know, eating some of the bread, you're hanging out, and all of a sudden you start hearing this tearing noise. And the curtain splits, and all of a sudden, you're looking at the Holy of Holies. Later on, it talks about how some of the people came to belief, the priests. I wouldn't be surprised if this was them from this thing. Because when Jesus dies, people live. Pilate lives. Robbers live. Chief priests live. And then literally, other people do too. In the craziest turn of events, only recorded by Matthew, the earth shook and the rocks split and the tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. First recorded instance of zombies. Isn't that interesting? How would you like to be dead and all of a sudden, hey, I got this special mission for you, and you now have to crawl out of a broken tomb and go back and show yourself to somebody? How would you like it if you were Uncle Frank's wife? All of a sudden, there's a knock at the door. It's Uncle Frank. Hey, can I come in? No, zombie man. Go away. You are eating my brains. Not today. Because when Jesus dies, people live. And in this amazing, I think this is the point of this. Only Matthew records it. It was probably one of the creepiest things that would ever happen, but it was enough to prove, once again, that when Jesus dies, people live. That means when Jesus was dead, that's when the victory happened. It wasn't just at his resurrection. The resurrection was the proof for every one of us. But it was on Good Friday. It was when he died. That's when it was done. That's when Jesus cries out, "It is finished. I'm done paying for this stuff." Now the victory can happen. Now we can celebrate who he is and what he's done. Because when Jesus dies, people live. And these people... Now, I feel bad. Yes, you got a question? That's what I was just about to say. I'm like, I feel bad for him. Like, dying once, I think, is terrible. Three deaths. Yeah, I don't know. I think the same thing with Lazarus, right? Lazarus, come forth, Lazarus. No, I'm fine where I'm at. And then he's like, oh, crud, here we go again. I know these feelings, and now he's going to die again. So, I'm guessing, unless they were all translated up into heaven like Elijah afterwards, I don't know. We have no idea what happened to these people. But let me tell you, do you think that when they told their story, do you think people believed? Yeah. What brought you here? The death of Jesus. Why are you alive? The death of Jesus. How are you walking among us today? The death of Jesus. Because when Jesus dies, people live. Verse 54, because when Jesus died, people live. When the centurion and those who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." The guy guarding Jesus' body on the cross, and it could have very well been the same guard that had inflicted wounds upon it. It could have been the same guard that actually put the nails in his wrists. It could have been the same guard that put that nail through his feet. And now he's looking at this and he's like, He's the Son of God. He is who he says he is. It's not Peter. He's not present. We don't even hear anything from John. Has he already left? None of the disciples are there. It's a centurion that has to say it. He's the Son of God. All these fringe people. They came. They saw what happened. They responded to it. Many women were there. Women? Why? because the men were scared. And the women, who were probably in a worse position than any man would be, they were watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs, and among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and Mary the mother of Zebedee's sons. I think Jesus has proven himself to you. I don't know all the stuff that's happened in your life, but I'm pretty sure that when you take a moment and look back over your life, you're going to see this totality of someone, something guiding and directing you, this entity trying to reach into your heart. And if you continue to say, I don't know what it is, or I continue to make excuses saying it's something else, it wouldn't even matter if Jesus literally walked into this room. It's time to let the walls down. It's time to stop resisting. It's time to say Jesus is who he says he is. And it's time for me to follow him. And let me tell you, when Jesus dies, you and I live. Let's pray. Father, for some of us, we have followed you, but we are a little scared and frightened. We run away. We don't really follow very closely. And we are in need of a reminder of who you are. Some of us, Lord, have not been around you very long. And yet we hear this incredible story and we see that you love these fringe people, all of these outsiders that come to faith. What an incredible story. And maybe even right now, our spirits are stirring and awakening, and these rattling bones that have been bleached and are just filled with decay are starting to come to life because you're breathing your spirit into us, because we're coming alive. And I pray that it would happen in our hearts now, that you would quicken us and stir us so that we might follow you. Because of your death, we are now alive. And we thank you for this incredible truth. And may we, like Pilate, not write it in one language, but write it in many languages, so that the whole world might know of who you are. In the name of Jesus, our Savior. Amen.